Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am joined by, well, I am Daniel Lemmy Price, and I am joined by Chad. I want to put others before me, but it just sounds weird. What's going on, Chad?
Hey, here we are. Here we are. How's it going, Dan?
It's going good. I'm good. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, so
I like that we do that, by the way. We give the illusion that we just logged on. And like I just saw your face, and then I'm like, "How's it going, Chad?"
Hey, how you been?
As if we hadn't just spent the last 20 minutes talking.
We were plotting world domination.
That's right.
Yeah. So where are we at? Are we still in the middle of the sea?
I think we are. I think the flood waters have crushed the enemy. That's where we ended.
How's your singing voice this morning? Are you ready to? We do a little singing.
Dude, I used to be able to sing back in the day a little bit. I was never great, but I did it enough that it was not terrible. I mean, honestly, you know, like I was a worship leader before I was a pastor, and people would be like, "Oh, that means you can sing," and it's like, no, it just means that I can sing just well enough to make me dangerous. That's all it is. Like, I mean, like, I can sing enough to not be a distraction, but that's about it. Like, I do not have a great voice. I can lead people in worship, and my voice will sound normal enough, and not not terrible, so that you're like, get this guy out of here. It's more like that guy sounds average. Like everything else in my life, it's pretty average.
My voice sounds pretty good if I turn the radio up real loud, so I really can't hear myself.
Well, dude, but I noticed. I mean, our worship leader was our liturgist was gone, and I like decided to step in.
Yeah.
Because I was like, I know this, dude.
How'd that go?
I mean, everyone was nice and said it was great, but I know. I mean, I was like, man, I can't sing these songs. What's going on? Like, I used to be able to, like, I'm out like it's years, out of, years, out, years out of practice. And you're, like, so that's why I say, like, I used to be okay. I'm pretty sure I suck now.
Well, I guess I want to ask you to sing Exodus 15 for us this morning.
Okay, good.
But you can work on it. Get your voice warmed up so you're ready next time. So that is where we're at. For everybody that's been listening along, we are beginning of chapter 15 of Exodus. We spent quite a bit of time on chapter 14, which is not unusual for us, as you know. We wrapped up the crossing of the Red Sea. We watched God divide the waters, lead the Israelites through, put the waters back in their place on top of the Egyptians. And that's kind of where we wrapped up last time. Israel sees the great power of the Lord, which he used against the Egyptians. They fear the Lord. They believe in the Lord and in his servant Moses. And that's the end of chapter 14. Now, if the rest of the book kind of went along in the same way that the first 14 chapters have, then we'd skip right to the next story. So we'd pick up with Israel on the opposite shore of the Red Sea, and we'd see them journeying on to Mount Sinai. But that's not what happens. They are going to, of course, journey on to Mount Sinai, but we have a little bit of a change here, at least in most of chapter 15, because instead of them proceeding on with the story, there is a song. It's called, in Hebrew, it's Shirat HaYam. That's what the Jews still call it today, the song at the sea, or the song of the sea. And it's also called the song of Moses. And it is it's a poetic, it's more than a poetic retelling of what just happened. It's a poetic retelling and interpretation and elaboration of everything that just happened at the crossing of the Red Sea. So there's a whole lot that's going on in this song or psalm or hymn or whatever you want to call it. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about it. And after we finish with it, then we'll be ready to move on with the rest of the narrative. This is a foundational song for the Old Testament, for the New Testament as well. And it's really, it's a continuing important song for Jews today. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, the Shirat Hayam, the Song of the Sea, is sung at every morning service in the synagogue. So Jews still sing this as part of almost kind of a daily hymn that is part of their own worship and liturgy.
That's because they still, certainly for a long time, but even still, like if you're hardcore, crossing the Red Sea is an identification issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why they do that.
Yeah.
I know we talked about this last week, but it is sweet that there's a song on the heels of it, and they still sing that song because the Red Sea is still something that is very much a part of their spiritual identity.
Yeah, I think that all of us tend to locate certain events, even in our own lives, via music. And we all know that, songs are kind of like musical time machines. You can hear one and all of a sudden, bam, you are right back to where you first heard that song, or you're right back in a situation where that song was playing. And so as soon as you hear the music and the words in your mind, you journey back to that particular time and place. So there's a way in which there's kind of a timelessness to certain songs and music. And that just, in our own individual lives, music and songs are connected in that way. But it's like that in the church too. There are certain hymns, certain psalms that root us in a particular time and give us a certain identity based upon what God was doing at that time. And it's certainly like that for the Song of the Sea for the Jews of the Old Testament as well as today. For the Old Testament, this was the identifying divine event for the Jews. They were the people that God redeemed from slavery in Egypt, the people that God brought through the Red Sea. So this is, as you say, this is their way of identifying who they are in connection with what God has done for them. So there's a whole lot here, and we'll talk about kind of the song in general as well as some of the particular parts of it as well. This is just about the oldest poetry that we have in the Old Testament. And if you look in the Book of Psalms, I know Dan, you preached on several of the Psalms recently, and the Psalms are some of the most familiar parts of the Scripture to people who spend some time in the Bible, because they're part of our worship, and we learn a few of them, or at least a few verses out of them in Sunday school. So people typically know the Psalms, and if you know the Psalms, you know that they, even within the 150 in that Old Testament hymnal, I mean, they span a whole lot of time. You've got Psalm 90, which is a song of Moses. Not this one, but it's another song by Moses. You got a bunch by David. You have some by anonymous authors. You have one by Solomon. So there's a whole lot of diversity, and there's a whole lot of historical span just in the Book of Psalms itself. So you have some older and some not so older poetry there. But if you look at the Song of the Sea, this is some of the oldest poetry that we have in the Old Testament. But, and this is kind of, this is sort of, I guess you could call this the foundational hymn that a lot of those other songs are built on top of, because this kind of sets the framework for what is to come later. I think it is significant just to point out the fact that singing, that songs have always been a part of the worship life of the people of God. This isn't something that, all of a sudden, you get to the Reformation and someone's like, we should sing in church. Singing has always been something that the people of God have done, because this is kind of the overflow of theology. There's a guy named Martin Fronsman who was a hymn writer, a theologian. He once wrote that theology is doxology, that is, theology is praise. Theology must sing. So it's this idea that that you can't have the acts of God just remain in words, but it has to become song, because that's that's what the people of God do. They sing, they praise, they recount what God has done for them, speaking it, but by singing it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you've got this kind of foundational hymn, which is going to tell us a little bit about a little bit more about what God was doing there at the crossing of the Red Sea. Starts out with this short introduction. It says, then Moses and the sons of Israel sang this song to the Lord. But if you skip, and then the song begins. But then if you skip down to verse 20, we have this. The prophetess, Aaron's sister, and also the sister of Moses, took the timbrel in her hand, and all the women went out after her with timbrels and with dancing, and answered them, quote, sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and his rider he has hurled into the sea. The way that the song begins back in verse 1 is exactly the way that Miriam sings it as well. So I think what you have going on here is kind of a what's called a antiphonal singing, where there's kind of a back and forth. We don't know exactly how this worked, but the fact that you have the whole song given to us, and then after it, it says that Miriam were saying this same thing, kind of gives the impression that there was a sort of a back and forth antiphonal singing between maybe the men and the women, or maybe between Miriam and some of the women and the rest of the people of Israel. We don't know, but this is one way that kind of can kind of be interpreted and envisioned as to how this song was sung. So you got musical instruments, you have singing, you have some sort of choir or antiphonal singing taking place at the same time. I'm just going to go through some of these sections, and I'll bring in some of the other theological implications of this as we move our way along. So it starts out with the words I just read. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. The horse and its rider he has hurled into the sea, kind of summing up everything that God has done for them. And then it goes on in the next few verses to kind of give a poetic interpretation of what God has accomplished at the Red Sea. It talks about how Pharaoh's chariots and his armor God cast into the sea, the choicest of his officers he drowned, how that they sank into the depths like a stone. And then it uses some other metaphorical language to describe what happened. But prefacing all of that is this. It's kind of a famous verse from this song. This is Exodus 15, verse 3. Is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Now, some of your translations might say the Lord is a warrior, but literally it's the Lord, Yahweh, is a man of war. Yahweh is his name. Now, I think this is pointing out, because this isn't, I don't know about you, but when I think about God, when I think about the Lord, I usually don't think about him in terms of being a man of war. But I think of him as being a creator, or we talk about him being a redeemer. The Spirit is a sanctifier. He's a savior. He's all of these things. But I don't think that we typically, as a warrior or as a man of war, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, because when we think about war, I mean, I hope we think this, that's war sort of a last resort. I mean, hopefully it's not something that we're like anxious to get into. I mean, I know there's people that are anxious to get into war, but I think that's problematic. Just saying, not trying to make a political statement or anything there, but I would hope that, that going to war with other people, where there is bound to be loss of life, is not something that we want to enter into lightly. And so, yeah, we look at war, even when it is necessary, as sort of like this unfortunate necessity, something that we try to avoid at all cost, last resort, when all other options have failed, kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the Lord being a warrior, you're like, well, I mean, he's God. He should probably never have to resort to that. So I think that's the first thing. I think that also we might be tempted to think like, oh, great, that's what I want. I want a great military type God who just like flexes all over his, you know, all over his enemies, right? And we definitely are prone to want that kind of thing. You know that the, I mean, the Jews, when they were Israelites, when they were under Roman captivity, were most certainly like wanting that kind of God.
It's kind of Messiah they wanted, right?
Yeah, that's the Messiah they were. They were like, yeah, give us like David, like amped up more. You know, that would be, that would be great.
Come in and wipe out the Romans.
Yeah, yeah. But what I think what you do see in Scripture is the language of God doing battle, or that sort of thing, being a warrior. I'm reminded of Psalm 24, where you have where Christ ascends the hill of Zion and says, you know, tells him to open the gates that the King of Glory may come through, and he says that he is the Lord mighty in battle. And this is an ascension psalm. This is what we refer to it as. And in that, then you're like, well, okay, well, who does he do battle with? And like, and against whom does he war? And it turns out that like he does war in a really backwards way, that he goes and defeats our enemies, but not like people I don't like, not other people groups that I don't like necessarily. He doesn't go around drowning. I think we want to take the Egyptians sometimes and say, like, well, like, I got my own Egyptians. And they're like this guy and this guy and this guy.
Yeah, let me give you a list, right?
Yeah. But missing the point that, like, Egypt and the Egyptians and Pharaoh, I mean, like, they represent sin, death, and the devil. And, like, and that's whom God is doing war with and who God goes and destroys. Like, those are your real enemies.
Mm-hmm.
What's rad is that the curse that we end up, the reason we're in this predicament where we have enemies, is because of the fall. And God says that there'll be enmity between us and the devil, right? Because the devil hates man because God created all things that were and then gave part of his creation the rest of it. Devil wasn't exactly into that. But the enmity is there. The enmity is not between, initially, necessarily God and the devil. Like, the enmity is placed between man and the devil. And then God becomes a man and takes up his cause and then defeats this, which is sweet. That's an awesome thing that happens. But, like, that's where the vast majority of, like, the warfare of God takes place, is taking up our cause and then defeating our enemies, which are not your neighbor, but rather the devil and hell and sin and death. Enemies that you have no chance at defeating on your own.
Yeah, it's like Paul says, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the principalities, against the dark forces of evil. And certainly those dark forces, sin and death and the devil, they do use people to accomplish their ends, but it's not the people that our battle is against. I think you have to interpret all of this battle imagery and the Lord is a man of war from the perspective of what you were describing, the ultimate battle of Christ against all the forces of evil, where he, like you said, he does things exactly backwards from what we'd expect. Instead of outright crushing his enemies, he lets them crush him, in order that in his defeat, they might be defeated, and then he emerges victorious on the day of resurrection.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, we talked about last week, so the violent aspect of baptism, you definitely see that taking place. You know, we have Peter talking about the flood being a representation of baptism, which obviously is tremendously violent, and cleanses the earth of unrighteousness, essentially, temporarily, very temporarily. You do have to, like, view the Red Sea then, is that, yes, something that we go through for sure in our baptism, but if you're going to see Christ there, I mean, Christ is the one who actually, like, undergoes the violence of baptism. I mean, Christ undergoes a different baptism. I mean, yes, he's baptized by John, but that baptism of fire that you don't want, that, like, baptism of wrath that you don't want, like, he went underwent that. he does not end up in the ark, as it were. He is outside, like, dealing with the flood. He does not end up, like, through the Red Sea, but ends up in the middle of it. Now he rises again, victorious in it. So it does not, he does not remain dead. But in all of those imagery, like, Jesus actually ends up the one, like, crushed and drowned and all this kind of thing, because he's the one who bears the sin of the world.
Yeah, he's the one who really, he becomes sin, because he becomes the curse, because he becomes the unrighteous one. He really becomes the enemy for us.
Right.
He becomes everything that is opposed to us, everything that that threatens our everlasting condemnation. Well, that's what he soaks into himself, so that it might have no more power over us, because he's taken away all of its power by letting it have its way with him. And so in a way, he becomes the Egyptians. He becomes Pharaoh in his own cruciform baptism, and his baptism on the cross, in which he takes everything opposed to us, including that which is within us, and he takes that into himself and ultimately defeats it by death, and then by his resurrection. So he does battle. He's a man of war, but he does everything wrong from the human perspective, because he lets the enemy be victorious over him. He walks right into the enemy camp unarmed and lets them overpower him, strip him, beat him, crucify him, so that it looks like he's defeated, and yet in his defeat is our victory. That's God's backwards way of accomplishing his will among us.
Yeah, God's weapon is fairly unattractive.
Yeah, it's unattractive. It's simple. It's foolish to us, as Paul will call it in 1 Corinthians. You know, the foolishness of the cross. But that's the way God works. He's always working with not only unconventional weapons, but the kind of weapons that no one would ever choose. My favorite story is in that regard is you may remember from the Book of Judges, when Gideon went out to battle against the Midianites, and God told him to take with him, you know, the clay jars and the torches and the trumpets, you know, so leave your swords and your shields and everything at home. All I want you to do is I just want you to bring out and some trumpets and some clay jars. And yet that's what God used in order to defeat the enemy. So he's always using foolish weapons in order to bring about deliverance for his people. That's what he does at the Red Sea. That's what he still does with us. And I was thinking as you were talking, Dan, too, about how the Egyptians and how Pharaoh in particular were kind of symbolic of evil, the evil forces that are arrayed against us. And there's explicit evidence in the Old Testament itself that's the way that the Israelites envisioned this as well. This is a little strange for us to think about, but in several passages throughout the rest of the Old Testament, in particular in the Psalms and in Isaiah, you have the crossing of the Red Sea described in a way that at least sounds to us almost kind of like mythology. Let me give you an illustration of that. This is from Isaiah chapter 51, verses 9 and 10. Isaiah says, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a pathway for the redeemed to cross over?" Now, Isaiah's talking about, of course, the crossing of the Red Sea there. But when he's talking about God's destruction of his enemies in the Red Sea, he doesn't mention Egypt and Pharaoh. Instead, he uses this language of Rahab and a dragon. And there's other places where Leviathan is mentioned in this same kind of connection. Now, this is actually kind of a a borrowing, if you will, or using a lot of the imagery that was common in the Near East. They had stories about the creator overcoming and overpowering sea monsters, cutting them up, destroying them in order to bring about some peace in the midst of chaos. It kind of be like if a modern day preacher were to use one of the Greek or Roman myths in order to illustrate something from the scriptures. Isaiah is not affirming the truth of these mythologies. Instead, he's using that as a way of picturing what God did for his people. But what he does is he talks about the dragon being in the waters. Rahab is kind of this mythological kind of imagery of some kind of power in the waters. Same with Leviathan. But the picture that God gives us in Isaiah and in Psalms that talk about this is of God overcoming the forces of chaos and evil that are in the waters in order to bring about peace and deliverance for his people. So in a way, you could say that what the Old Testament is doing is it is joining up the Egyptians and Pharaoh with this imagery of evil and chaos. It's drawn from their own culture and some of the stories that were circulating in their culture. This is the way that the Old Testament Israelites were telling us that more is involved than simply God defeating the Egyptians at the sea. This is at a particular point in time, at a particular location, God demonstrating what he's going to do ultimately in his destruction of all forces of evil and deliverance for all people in the work of his son. So anyway, there's more that takes place with the interpretation of the Song of the Sea later on through the Psalms and through Isaiah. Another thing that I think is worth pointing out here is that the Song of the Sea doesn't just talk about what happened then when the Israelites went across it, but it has a wider focus as well. I'm going to skip ahead here to, I'll pick it up here at verse 13. So the song goes on. It says, "In your loving kindness, you led the people that you had redeemed. In your strength, you guided them to your holy habitation." Now, continues on with verse 14. "The peoples have heard. They tremble. Anguish has gripped the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling, grips them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm, they are motionless as stone until your people pass over, O Lord, until the people pass over whom you have purchased or whom you have redeemed." Now, notice what the song is doing. It's not just talking about what happened at the Red Sea. We've skipped ahead. I mean, the song is talking about things that haven't even happened yet, but it describes it as already having happened. But as the inhabitants of Edom, as the inhabitants of Moab and the Canaanites, as they all hear about what God has done for his people at the sea, then this kind of fear and dismay is going to grip them. And we have this powerful image of them like melting like wax before the fire of the Lord. They melt away as those who have no strength. So there's a forward-looking message that the psalm gives us as well. It's not just talking about what happens now, but it's also talking about the impact that this is going to have as word of God's deliverance spreads to the surrounding nations. And then it wraps up by taking us even farther. Verse 17 and 18 wrap up the psalm, and here's what they say. It says, "You will bring them," talking about God's people, "you will bring them and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, the place, O Lord, which you have made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established." And then it wraps up, "The Lord shall reign forever and ever." So the psalm moves kind of through three different stages. It's all sung there at the shore of the Red Sea, but the song talks about what God does at the Red Sea. And then it talks about how this is going to make an impact upon the nations which surround Israel. And then finally, it even brings them to the point of the construction of the tabernacle and the resting of that tabernacle on the mountain that God has provided for his sanctuary or for his dwelling place. Now think about this. What the song does is it takes us from the shore of the Red Sea all the way to the peak of Mount Zion in 18 verses. So it spans this whole history that's really just beginning now. It takes us from the shore of the Red Sea through the 40 years in the wilderness, through the conquest of the promised land, all the way to the construction of the tabernacle and the temple and its resting place on Mount Zion. So what the song does is it gives us this broad view of not only what God has just accomplished for his people, but what he's going to accomplish for them. And you could kind of say that the Exodus will really come to its completion when the sanctuary rests on Mount Zion. That's really when the Exodus comes to an end. Not when they've crossed the Red Sea, not even when they've reached the promised land, but the Exodus finally comes to an end when the tabernacle rests on top of Mount Zion and God is with his people and God has his people where he wants them to be. So that's the psalm. It's kind of a, I guess you could call it kind of like a telescoping of history all in one psalm where you see this distant goal, as if it's close, even though it's many years from now. So you have a summation of what God has done then and what he's going to do in this full picture that the psalm paints for us.
You know, Chad, we kind of skipped over the most important part.
What's that?
Of the psalm.
Tell me.
That is that tambourines are acceptable within worship.
It's that's right.
I know it's unfortunate. I too want to believe it's not so, but it's true.
It's right there in the Bible, verse 20, right?
There it is. Tambourine acceptable, apparently.
Miriam, the prophetess, Aaron's sister. Well, my translation is timbrel, but I think you could probably translate that tambourine. Here we have musical instruments right here.
It's there, man. It's there. I know people would be horrified because, I mean, as a former worship leader, there's nothing that drives you more nuts than the tambourine. There's nothing. You don't want to see a congregation with a bunch of tambourines. You know that's not going to be good. But, yeah, you know, what are you going to do?
And somebody comes out and they quote Exodus 15 to you. There's really nothing much you can do at that point, right?
That's right. That's when you got the drummer that wants to play and he's like, crashing cymbals, bro, and you're like, dang it. It's all true.
It's all there. Yeah, so you've got, man, there's a lot packed in here. You've got history, you've got redemption, you've got music, you've got musical instruments. It's all right there at the Red Sea.
Yeah, I mean, this might be like, I know this is like a massive rabbit hole, but I do think, you know, there are segments of Christianity that would insist upon a cappella worship with no instruments at all. That's something I've just like never been able to get my head around. Like I can appreciate some a cappella. Sometimes, I mean, I like it when it's just voices. I think that's cool sounding sometimes. But the idea that it's wrong to use instruments. I mean, you're nowhere commanded that you must use instruments. So I'm not reversing that law and like somehow say like, no, you have to use all these things. It doesn't just say anywhere that you have to use the tambourine or the lyre or the crashing cymbal. It certainly doesn't say you have to use the organ. That's not in there. But it's certainly, I don't know how in the world you could ever pull from the scriptures or get the idea from the scriptures that somehow musical instruments are forbidden and it must be voices only. That just seems untenable biblically.
Yeah, that's a great example of kind of two different ways of approaching this very broad subject. I speaking from the perspective of the reformers, Lutheran reformers in particular, they went by the approach that if something that is happening in the church is not opposed to the gospel, if it's a tradition or a practice is not opposed to the gospel, then it was kept, or maybe it was reformed in order that it might serve the gospel. But there were others that approached it from the perspective that unless you have something that is explicitly commanded to be practiced in the church, then it should not be. And that's kind of where they get this idea of no musical instruments. So there's no command to using musical instruments, and so you should not. Whereas the reformers said, well, there's no command that you shouldn't, so you can.
Yeah, in fact,
a question of freedom versus legalism, in my perspective.
Yeah, and in fact, not only is it not forbidden, but there's examples of it being done without rebuke.
Yeah, it's in the Psalms. Psalm 150 talks about trumpets and harps and lyres and timbrels and stringed instruments and loud cymbals and resounding cymbals.
They got like an orchestra going on.
Yeah. I mean, it would be kind of be strange in a church that forbade the use of musical instruments to be singing Psalm 150, but in a church where these instruments are forbidden to be used. That would be kind of it's like sitting down while you're singing stand up for Jesus. It's just kind of, it's the dissonance that's going on there.
Can we be real right now? Now it's time, in these last final moments, it's time for honesty. Of weird things that happen in church. There's sometimes you like sing a song or like recite a psalm that talks about like says something like, you know, we bow down or whatever, this sort of thing, right? We like there's all in the psalms and in the hymnody that we use based on certain psalms, we will say things like we lift our hands or raise our hands. We will say like we bow down. And you're doing neither of them. I've always felt weird about that, like where I'm like, I feel I'm like what? As I'm singing it, but I'm not. I'm like, well, I'm not bowing down right now, I'm not lifting my hands, so that's weird.
I'm not the same thing. I will lift up my hands to your sanctuary, but then I'm thinking, yeah, but I'm not lifting up my hands, or I will bow down, or I will kneel before you, but I'm like sitting there or standing there, and no one around me is kneeling or bowing down. there is this kind of disconnect between what we say or what we sing and what our body is doing, and I honestly do think that's something that that the church needs to think more about is the participation of the body in worship, that it's not just, you know, we don't just take our heads to worship. Right. We're not just like brains on a stick. Our whole body is involved in worship. In fact, the Hebrew word for worship literally means to bow down with your face to the ground. So, I mean, it's not like some kind of abstract worship. The word itself means to get on the ground and put your face on the ground. That's how you worship. So it's a bodily activity. And there's all sorts of bodily activity involved in worship in the Old Testament. I think that's something we need to think more about as Christians today.
We're just used to our stuff, man.
That's right.
That's it. We're just used to the way we do it. But I'm glad that somebody else has felt that that disconnect when that happens, where you're like, am I lying right now?
One of these days, I'm just going to fall on the floor and everyone's going to be like, why is he doing that? No one's going to realize that they just sang that they were doing the same thing, but their bodies told a different story. It's like we're singing one thing with our mouth, but our bodies are telling a different story.
Yeah. One of these days, Chad, I want your hands to just, your hands just to shoot up in worship right in the middle of a song, right in the psalm reading or something. All of a sudden your hands go up like, hey, you know what? I'm going to do it this time. I'm tired of waiting.
I'm going to start a trend.
I refuse to lie in church. I'm going for it. All right, guys. I know that was a super deep way to end it. But hey, you know, we bunny trail where we bunny trail. So hey, you guys, you know what? If you listen to this when it comes out, you've only got a few days to get in on the early bird special rate for the Here We Still Stand conference in October 19th through 21. Me and Chad will be there It'd be a real shame if you were not there with us, because we want to hang out with you. So if you go over herewestillstand.com, you can go and see all the speaker lineup, the schedule. You can register. You can get your room reserved, all that. And you probably want to do that before the end of this month. And this month, in case you're listening later on, is March. Because the rate will go up April 1st. And I don't want that to happen to you. I don't want that to happen to you. I want you to get in while the rate is low. So go over there, check it out, and make it happen. Chad, we'll see you next week, man.
All right, man. See you then.